Good morning, Seattle, and in other realms and spaces. It's Dan in Little Saigon, and I think it is April the 24th. I'll double check here on my calendar. Yep, it's April the 24th, 2019, and it is. I'm gonna get ready for work here in about an hour, but I'm not feeling so great right now, and I felt like maybe a podcast will help clear the ballast, clear the system. I don't know, kind of like a maybe it's like having a good crap. I really don't know. I was reading a Zero Hedge article yesterday, and I'll just briefly discuss this. I was reading this Zero Hedge article yesterday about, I think it was Twitter, and how in non-GAAP terms, that means generally accepted accounting principles, in non-GAAP terms, the Twitter Corporation was doing really well. And I thought, you know what? In non-GAAP terms, my health is quite good. You know, I could say my doctor now gives me two reports on my health. He gives me the normal report that tells the truth. And then he gives me another report about my health, the non-GAAP report. And it turns out in non-GAAP terms, I'm extremely healthy and I'm likely to live to be a billion years old. So that's all good news. In non-GAAP terms, Dan is doing really well. In actual real terms, I'm having a bad couple days. Now, for my listeners, you might ponder the question, Dan, how could that fucking be so? You finally have a job again. You're finally making some money. You're paying bills. Everything should be great. And in your defense, or perhaps in your favor, I did on Saturday drink a lot of absinthe, and it is my recollection that absinthe, that alcoholic beverage that contains some kind of crap that some people think will make you feel really cool like a vampire, whatever, it's probably the case that absinthe is really bad for you, and I drank too much of it, and I am simply still suffering the repercussions. That is entirely plausible. But I really don't think that's the whole story. Last Thursday, I think it was Thursday, could have been Wednesday. Last week was a blur. I was on the bus and I was talking with a coworker. Now, so you know, typically I don't talk on the bus. I don't stare at the glowing rectangle, your smart device, so ironically named. No, I don't stare at the little glowing rectangle. I just generally don't talk on the bus, and people aren't supposed to. Now, here's the thing. A member of the Danish wing of my family this last weekend pointed out that the bus is an enclosed space. So it is kind of a douchey thing to do to just really be a blustering idiot out loud. And I would have to say that's basically probably true. When I was younger, more people were talking on the bus, so it was like a natural white noise. But now it's basically just a bunch of people staring at their little glowing rectangles, usually with their earbuds in. So you could be yelling and screaming, which I was not, and they would not hear what you were saying. But the bus driver that has to hear everything, and I don't know, maybe they have microphones in the back. I was in the back of the bus, and I wasn't really that loud, but maybe I was. I don't know. I have some hearing damage. Full disclosure, I think between working for my dad up in the woods around chainsaws and large diesel engines, and being in the military, I think I have some hearing damage. I know that when I got my out processing from the Army, a specialist showed me, she said, you know, sir, you see that right there? You know, those are sounds you're never going to hear again. And I think she chuckled, which I thought was funny. Some people would say that's insensitive. I think it's funny as fuck. You know, guess what, sir? You're never going to hear those notes again. Thank you very much. Anyways, I have a little bit of hearing damage, so it's possible. It is possible. I don't know. It is possible that I was too loud. But I was talking about shit. I said a few things. I even made a comment about women getting the right to vote. And here's the thing about that. I think voting is stupid. So probably the most genius thing any woman or group of women could possibly do would be to request the right to not vote for the rest of all eternity. I think that would be a vote I would vote for. I would vote for my right to not vote, to not have it held over my head every 2 years, to not have people being stupid around me. Yeah, the whole thing is absurd and ridiculous, but, you know, that's kind of my point. I think voting is stupid. I think it's a button connected to nothing. You go into the booth and you push the button and you think you're doing something, but it really is like that button on that web page 10 or 15 years ago that your business owner would say, Dan, you're a web programmer. We need a button that says save. And I try to explain to them that it already auto saves. And they said, but we still need the button. So you put the button on the page, but it does nothing. That is voting. Anyways, I said some things on the bus. I was honest. I mentioned this in a previous podcast, but it's worth repeating. I said that I enjoyed sex, but I hated relationships. Listen, I was dumped. People who get dumped have jaded perspectives on things. But the point is this, and this is where my Danish family member was right. It is a bus. It's an enclosed space. I shouldn't have said shit. I think the bus driver wanted to kick me off. Actually, I wish she had. But I am sorry. I owe Seattle an apology. You know, the worst thing you can do is become the thing you seek to destroy. You know, the people of Seattle, essentially their entire culture, I find offensive these days. Seattle used to be less douchey. Seattle used to be less of a scumbag paradise. But it's been overrun, and it's not about foreigners, it's not about Indians or Chinese people. Oh crap, here goes my alarm. Yeah, I was gonna wake up, fucking... Ugh. Fuck you. Yeah. I was gonna wake up later today, like right about now. So I guess I do. I owe Seattle an apology. I am sorry, and I'm sorry to the people on that bus. Believe it or not, I am. I'm sorry that I acted like the person I despise. Frankly, I listen to the shit that people in Seattle say every day of the week, and it mostly offends me. Their general attitude, especially when it comes to the war party, which they never talk about. Okay? In 2014, when all this bullshit around Russia was getting kind of stupid, I decided, and this is how much of a fool I am, I decided to try to lead a protest down at Westlake Center. I got about 5 people to show up. I got 5 people to hold a sign and say, we think that the warmongering towards Russia is dangerous. We think it's stupid. We think you want to bring back the Cold War. And why? We know for certain that Puerto Rico is far less American than Crimea is Russian. These are facts, okay? I'm sorry. Texas, we have less of a right to Texas than the Russians do to Crimea. Do you fucking understand what I'm saying? Do a little fucking research. But the problem is, most of Seattle is part of the war party now. They'll call themselves Democrats. They'll call themselves Republicans. Some of them will even call themselves socialists. But God forbid you take away the security state, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, CIA money away from Google or Amazon or Microsoft or Facebook, probably too, and definitely fucking Boeing. You know, I said this in previous podcasts, probably. I said this yesterday at work. It was dangerous to say. I think I said this on the bus. And this may have been the thing that pissed people off so fucking much. This may have been the fucking thing I said on the bus that almost got everybody wanting to kill me, to be blunt. But I said this to my sister in the car going to Easter to see family. I said, wouldn't it be amazing if only for 2 fucking weeks, just 2 weeks, only 2 weeks, wouldn't it be amazing if only for 2 weeks the world could just have no war happening? I don't know. I don't mean like there's going to be no like murders and rapes and criminals stealing from banks. I don't mean the horror and tragedy of everyday existence. I mean war. 2 weeks without war. 2 weeks without secret assassinations. 2 weeks without drone killings. 2 weeks without dropping bombs on each other. The whole world agrees just for 2 fucking weeks that we're not going to go around killing each other. But you know what? Here's the problem with that. At about day 13, people would be thinking, can we try 2 months? And by day 45, it'll be like, you know, maybe we should try a decade without war. Because once people get a taste for it, ordinary people. They would demand more of it. They would like less of the mass killing, less of the setting people's towns on fire so they become displaced people, refugees. They'd like less of the destruction and the murder and the chaos. In the name of what? You know, in America, they say in the name of freedom. But since 9/11, this country has become more of a two-bit pathetic police state. So no, I don't see the freedom expanding, you stupid fuck. So yeah, of all the terrible things I said on the bus, you know, talking about how I just wasn't happy about trying to date, which I think is completely reasonable, talking about the fucking women voting, fuck, if they understood, they'd realize that A, I don't have anything against women, and B, I think voting is stupid. So there, just take and process that. But probably the worst thing I said on that fucking bus that day was that people in Seattle do not want their war rice bowl taken away. They would never want that. If you tried to advocate for 2 weeks of peace, you would get a whole bunch of people protesting against you with fancy signs. I made my signs by hand, you know, with big old Sharpies. But there was a protest right next to me. I think this was March the 14th, 2014, or something close to that. There was a protest right next to me that had these fancy signs that were all printed out like at fucking Kinko's and shit. Yeah, the war party is the most popular party in the United States of America. It is the most popular party amongst the elite, no matter how hipster, no matter how millennial they are, no matter how much you might think they're on the edge because they just bought some really cool shoes at Doc Martens. The war party is the party of murder and death. So yeah, I do owe Seattle an apology. And here's the other thing too. If I really hated Seattle, and if I hated all these people that I say I despise, would I really be here? I mean, yes, it's true. The choice between coming back to Seattle, it was between that or drowning myself in the White River in Indianapolis. So really, it's not necessarily a huge compliment. But I did find Seattle preferable to slowly drowning in freezing water. And man, that is kind of a compliment in a way. I ride on this bus every day. You know, part of my dread, and I think this is why I'm not feeling so good. Part of my dread isn't so much what I might say, but what I might hear and see. I don't stare at the glowing rectangle. I don't have a smartphone. I don't want one. And I simply see what's going on around me. And it does seem as if the world has changed since I was younger, that Seattle has changed a lot. And it continues to change. And it's not heading in a direction that, you know, is very good. And it's not special. You know, if I learned anything from fleeing Seattle in 2014, I learned the following. And actually, I knew this. I have this video of that experience, and I'm on the Amtrak, and I'm saying to myself, and I'm actually saying this to the camera, you know, this is very much like changing the seats on an airplane. It's the same airplane. It's going the same direction. I'm just changing seats. And I knew that heading to Indianapolis from Seattle was probably exactly like that. I knew that deep down inside. But it seemed to make sense at the time. It seemed to be a rational response to the situation, that I would try to go back to a place that kind of made me happy years and years ago. And it's not, you know, it is irrational, but it's not that uncommon. You know, people go through periods of loss, and really, you know, I don't want to go into Kubler-Ross, but you could simplify Kubler-Ross in the following way. There are three stages. The first stage of grieving is madness. Denial, anger, bargaining, this is madness. The first stage of grieving is madness, in my opinion. And I went a little crazy, and I don't think I completely recovered even yet. You know, it's one of those things. You think you're in love with someone or a place or a time, and that all falls apart, and then you recognize maybe you were wrong all along, or maybe the whole thing was bullshit. If I really hated Seattle, I wouldn't be living here. If I really hated Seattle, I'd be dead already. The truth is, I have a church in Seattle. There's a church I go to. It's not technically in Seattle. It's in Burien. And which, and let's be blunt about the name Burien. It really does sound like the last name of a dentist that is also a serial killer. I just have to get that out of my system. But Burien is a fine place, and I have a church I go to in Burien, and it's a good church. I don't know if I'm a good Christian, but I know that it's a good Christian church. I have a job, and currently the people I work with, they seem mostly okay, which these days is pretty fucking good. And assuming I don't go crazy, assuming I don't flake out, assuming that my stomach doesn't explode because I feel like I'm a failure, assuming that I can deal with the fact that I have to go to work each day at a place I don't really love. I don't love who I'm working for. But the thing is, in Seattle, if you're a software engineer and a contractor, in all likelihood, you're working for one of five companies, you know, probably through a contracting agency, which means you're not a full-time Oompa Loompa. You know, there's the Oompa Loompas, and then there's the rest of us. We're like the second-tier Oompa Loompas. Those are the ones you never see in the fucking movie. They're the ones who live underneath the floor. So yeah, if you're like me, you're a contractor. In Seattle, you work your job, you hope it's okay, you hope you can stomach it, you hope that some creepy dude doesn't come up from behind you who also happens to be your manager and gives you random, you know, shoulder grabs and back rubs. You kind of fucking hope that shit doesn't happen. Yesterday, my manager touched me on the arm. You know what? Normally, I guess if it's a one-off thingy, he comes from a Latin culture, I kind of just, I rationalized it. But here's the deal. I don't know why anyone would feel entitled to touch another person at work, especially when the person is typing at a computer. But that's my point. So far in this job, people seem okay. And I'm hoping that's the case. So far, it seems like I can do this work without vomiting. But it's still a company I don't really love. It's still a culture, the Seattle culture, the zeitgeist of today, that often horrifies me. And I think it's mixed up and broken. You know, it's people who are so confused about their existence that they rationalize whole-scale murder. Like I said, and I gotta tell you, I know I would get everyone hating me because people might lose jobs. Imagine if for 2 weeks, no nation on earth waged war against another. Just for 2 weeks. I don't think it could happen. You know, I don't think we're capable of it any longer. I think the only thing we know how to do is the same stupid shit until we can't do that any longer. That's it. We have an old broken jalopy with a nearly burnt out engine. We know it can't go another 100 miles, but we keep just, you know, our foot is heavy on that throttle and there's no way we're going to stop. We will go in this vehicle, this monstrosity. We will ride the ugly magical crocodile of our corporate infrastructure and our government of tyranny. We will ride that magical crocodile until the crocodile explodes. That is the kind of suicidal commitment people have come to. You know, I don't want to look up the name, but it brings me back once again to that quote of that famous jurist. He said, the U.S. Constitution's not a suicide pact. Well, I'll be blunt, you fuck. I wish you were here right now. I'd tell you straight up. It's looking like a suicide pact to me. It's looking like a lot of people are riding this fucking crocodile until it explodes. And my joy is I get to sit on a bus every day and try to pretend everything is fine. So I don't know what to tell you. I owe Seattle an apology because I was being too harsh. It's not because there aren't problems, but the problems are everywhere. And I don't know if that makes you feel better. But whatever you think is wrong with Seattle, it's happening everywhere. It's happening in Los Angeles. It's happening in Portland. It's happening in Chicago. It's happening in Indianapolis and Dayton, Ohio. It's happening in New York City. It's happening in Saratoga Springs. It's happening in Miami, Florida. It is everywhere. It's in Houston, Texas, you fuck. The same problems. They're not exactly the same shape. Okay, the homeless people aren't the same homeless people, but are there homeless people all over the country? I hate to break it to you, there are. It is true, some places attract more homeless people, okay? I would hate to be homeless in Kodiak, Alaska, But I would venture to guess that even Kodiak, Alaska has its own kind of homeless problem. So I was harsh on Seattle because really, the things I was seeing here, they were happening everywhere. And a lot of people have seen decay already. Like, if you experienced Detroit from 1960 until the year 2000, which means you're older than me, but you're not dead yet, you probably saw Detroit go through a period of decline, and you wondered to yourself, what's going on? So in some sense, every city in the country right now is Detroit, and I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't. I wouldn't claim the homeless issue has easy solutions, but my concern is that, well, homeless are so easy to blame. It's so easy to blame the weak. So I don't know. You know, I think that there is always this danger, especially for people like myself that come off as a nativist and maybe even a racist, because you would say, well, Dan, you just don't like the way society's changing in terms of the color of people's skin or stuff like that. It's not really about that. You know, it's not about race. It's not about gender. It's about right and wrong. We were supposed to be a free country. I don't really care what people look like or what they do. As long as they're not throwing it in my face and violating my sovereignty, I'm okay with that. You know, the reason why I really owe the apology to the bus riders and to the bus driver is because they were a captive audience. It's not like they could pull a ripcord and jump off. But that was a fairly atypical moment for me. I would never do something like that under normal circumstances. And what I do on the bus is I'm usually just, like I said, quiet there, staring out the window as the world goes by, seeing what I see. A lot of it I don't like. But there is that danger of coming off as kind of a racist or a nativist. I am not. I'm not advocating for a golden age. There was no golden age, folks, okay? There was a time in the 19th century when the crocodile, aka the US government, was so small that for the most part, all it could do was harass Native Americans. And then for a period of time, the crocodile split in two and went to war with itself. That happens to crocodiles as they get older. That was the Civil War. But the bottom line is, for most of the 19th century, the crocodile was mostly, you know, attacking Native Americans, which is terrible, which is monstrous. But it's one of the reasons why a lot of, you know, European Americans will look back at the 19th century and say, well, that was the golden age. Well, listen, it was the golden age as long as you weren't a Native American. But if you were a Native American, it was a horrific age. It was an age of destruction. And then the crocodile got bigger. And I would argue 1913, as many people would also recognize, was a turning point. I think Teddy Roosevelt wanted, you know, I think Teddy Roosevelt was the president who pointed the ship in this direction. But it was 1913 when the ship loaded up on nuclear fuel. And that was the, you know, the Federal Reserve Act and the creation of the income tax. At that point, after that point, the crocodile is on steroids. The crocodile is going to grow massively. And the crocodile will want to look at everybody. So you're going to need an FBI with a Hoover who has a massive database of everybody. You're going to need all that shit because the crocodile now has grown in size. It was merely a few thousand pounds at the end of the 19th century. After the Federal Reserve Act, it was suddenly a million-pound crocodile. A giant, giant fucking government of tyranny. And that's what we have today. And I don't think there's any way it's going to stop. I mean, I've used the analogy of putting the crocodile on a diet because that's what a lot of libertarians sell. A lot of small government Republicans and Democrats will try to sell this. They'll try to sell, well, we can put them on a diet. We can cut the defense budget. Why don't you go try that? Why don't you try to cut it in half and see what happens to you? See what happens to your family. See what happens to the world. Why don't you try and reduce the scope and size of the national security state and see what happens to your world? No one's going to do this. There is no diet for the crocodile, but this is the thing. The thing about Seattle, the thing about the culture that bothers me is this. that we were once a society that was about freedom, at least philosophically. Maybe we totally screwed up. No, we definitely screwed up in terms of actuality, but at least we profess liberty as a value. And if you ask me, liberty's not a luxury. You say, well, Dan, it's a luxury and we can't afford it. No, it's the other way around, you stupid fuck. We can't afford to not have a free society, unless, of course, we want to become extinct. If our goal is extinction, then the tyranny, police state bullshit is the perfect solution. It is the final solution. But if our goal is not extinction, then we need to have a free society. That also means every once in a while, some crazy, fat, middle-aged, burnout computer programmer on the Metro bus might forget himself and say some things that are kind of annoying. And your options are listen to him for a bit until you put your earbuds in, or mock him, or record him, or you can shiv him, or you can report him to the secret police. I think that in a free society, you might have to put up with a little bit of an annoyance once in a while. But truly, in that case, I was in the wrong. So I think in most cases on the bus in a free society, no jackass is going to be giving fucking speeches, you know, in the hallway. Or at least very few. But again, I don't know. I don't think people, it's not that they don't believe. They don't get taught. There's no history they have. Kids get taught Marxism. They get taught socialism. They get taught statism. They get taught the only way to solve a problem is with government. That's it. It's no accident that the musical Hamilton's so fucking popular. Hamilton was a bastard. Hamilton wanted to turn the United States of America into a giant plantation. Mission accomplished. You can summarize my angst, my anxiety, my issues with Seattle almost in terms of what I just said. Hamilton's one of those musicals that would be very popular for your upper middle class, you know, well-schooled, well-worked, good job for one of the major miniature crocodiles, Amazon or Google. Hamilton would be their favorite musical. It would make them feel so good about their bullshit. What if the truth was this country was only free for a couple years, like from 1783 to maybe 1789? Those years where we had a peace treaty with England, but essentially there was no constitution, just the Declaration of Independence, which for many of us seems like enough of a document. What if that was the only time of freedom, and that's why nobody ever fucking talks about it? They gloss it over, they say things like Whiskey Rebellion and General Washington went to, you know, to quell that bullshit. But the truth is, we don't talk about it much. What if that was the only time in this entire fucking country's history where everyone had a chance at freedom? Everyone, including the Native Americans, because at least we weren't building giant armies yet. You know, we weren't arming Cossacks, so to speak, to go off and kill the peasants. We weren't doing that yet. Anywho, this is the disquiet of my soul. This is where I'm at. This is why on a day like today, and it's important to remind myself, this is also how I felt after I moved to Indianapolis in 2014. You know, I was working for a good company. I had a good job. I even had people who, you know, were kind of okay to work with. But I had a general disquiet of the soul, and I still have it. You know, in a physical sense, it sort of shows up as this kind of stomach. My stomach feels sick, but I know that I'm certain there's nothing wrong with me. It's just I have a general disquiet of the soul right now. Anywho, I don't know if any of this makes any sense, but for this Wednesday morning, it's hump day. I never quite understood what hump day was supposed to be, really, but it is hump day. And you need to get out there and get to work and hump yourself to work and think about the nature of reality and remind yourself every day that the world at this point in human history could not go, it really could not go for 2 weeks without people having bombs dropped on each other someplace.